This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, are immigration tensions causing hate crimes? And Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld won't commit to a date for withdrawing troops from Iraq. Joining us to discuss these topics and more from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., Republican strategist Tara Setmeyer and Joe Davidson, an editor at The Washington Post. Plus, at member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University. Welcome all y'all.
Hello,
good morning. Just figured I would throw out an all y'all since we started out with New Orleans today. Let's go to the South again. The Southern Poverty Law Center is reporting that tensions over illegal immigration are contributing to a rise in hate groups and hate crimes across the nation. Since the year 2000, there's been a 33% jump in these types of crimes. Is the administration in a position to do something about the rhetoric around immigration? Who should be really taking some responsibility for dealing with how this very tough issue is being discussed in society?
Well, I think that the administration, certainly President Bush, has not tried to escalate the rhetoric in any sort of hateful way. I mean, President Bush, I think, is in a sense cast as the moderate in this debate, not particularly to the, certainly not to the far right, perhaps not as far left as many would like, but in this particular debate, I think he certainly finds as many Republicans further to the right than he is, and I think he finds many Democrats basically supporting his position.
Tara, the president was in Yuma, Arizona, just recently, where, again, it seemed very difficult to come up with a Republican position on immigration. A lot of difficult questions, you know, do we build a fence? Do we criminalize immigrants? Do we criminalize employers who take on undocumented immigrants? What can and should the president be doing about, you know, positioning himself, but also about cutting off at the pass any kind of rise in hate crimes?
Well, this is a debate that's we haven't seen in about 20 years within the Republican Party. The divisions within the party itself on the very clear lines that have been drawn are unlike any other debate we've seen in a long time, and it poses a significant challenge to the president to see how he can bridge that gap and use whatever political capital he has left. This is the immigration issue is one of the issues I think that he can potentially reinvigorate his presidency on if he's able to get a bill passed along the lines of, well, it's not amnesty, but we're going to put the illegals behind the line, not the front of the line. It needs to be earned citizenship, and we're going to put up a fence on the border only partly. The National Guard's going to go on the border, but not in a law enforcement capacity, but in a supportive one. I think he, in this case, as Joe stated, he is the moderate here. As far as hate crimes, this debate is such an emotional one because of the bullying tactics of the pro-illegal immigration groups. When you fly the American flag upside down and you're flying a Mexican flag in support of rights that you technically aren't entitled to because you are illegal, that will enrage the most sensible Americans, not necessarily the hate groups. And hate groups innately are hate groups because they don't need this as an excuse. That you know, the name implies that they're irrational and they're going to hate individuals. So as far as there are hate laws on the books and each state and localities can handle these, I don't think that there needs to be a federal response.
You know, I would add to this that actually I think when you look at the overall response to immigration and the number of the statistics stated for the increase in the number of hate groups since the immigration debate has come about, it actually hadn't been as large as it could have been. You know, our nation is still a very young nation. And when you look at but we are starting to get some history. And when you look at how we have treated African-Americans historically, the way that we dealt with immigration when it was with the Chinese at the end of the 19th century, when we dealt with the Japanese during the World War II internment, and now as Latinos, we're starting to, I think, sense what is the right way to approach these kinds of issues and what's the wrong way. And I think that what is heartening about, even though, you know, we're talking about hate crimes and the rise in the number of hate groups, the fact is we are probably better now than we've ever been in our history with dealing with an issue as complex as this. And so my point is that as we move forward in our nation, you can see right now, and as Joe and Tara pointed out, that we don't have any, our president is the moderate in this situation. So the idea that hate groups are springing up, they don't have the support that they would have had 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 25 years ago. Our nation is much
better. But it's
also true
that they certainly do have some support. I don't think we should underestimate the hate groups. When you have situations such as in Russellville, Alabama, according to the report, where you had like 300 Klansmen and Klan supporters yelling such things as "Let's get rid of the Mexicans," you know, in East Hampton, New York. So all of this just isn't on the border. On April 29th, there was a person who was arrested for threatening two Hispanic teenagers while holding a machete and a chainsaw and holding the blade to the throat of one of these victims. I don't think that we can underestimate these incidents, that the administration is not fueling the rhetoric.
Let me get Tara in on one thing.
Okay.
And all of you can comment on this. I'm just struck by the difference between the U.S. and many European nations. Not all, but in many European nations, including Germany, even if you're born in the country, that doesn't make you a citizen. It has a lot more to do with your heritage. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., you have a lot of mixed families in terms of immigration status, because if you have two parents who come from Mexico without any kind of papers and they have a kid in the States, or two or three, those kids are U.S. citizens. Tara, let me start with you first, and feel free to jump in, Joe and Nat. Do you foresee, amid all of these proposals, a day when we could change that? We could say, oh, it doesn't matter where you're born. If your parents don't have status, you're not a citizen. I know some people have suggested that.
Well, that's something that's one of the more problematic elements of our immigration policy right now. I think that it should be, if a policy should be reversed, it should be that if you are not a legal citizen in this country and you have a child here, that child should not be granted automatic citizenship. That is extremely problematic. And I think that's contributed to a lot of the increase in illegal border crossings, because women come over here knowing they'll get free medical care paid for by the American taxpayer, and their child becomes a citizen, then it becomes a humanitarian issue. Well, are we going to deport families? Are we going to split them up? And it becomes an emotional issue. And then we have the debate that we have now. Just one more quick point on hate crimes. The flip side to an example that Joe gave is that oftentimes a hate crime, that definition can be overblown. It becomes an issue of political correctness. Because you call someone a Mexican, or because, is that now a hate crime? Or in Colorado, where you had a ban on anything that was red, white, and blue, they couldn't fly American flags because for fear of bigotry and violence against illegals or immigrants. Now, when did patriotism become bigotry in America? So there's a flip side to that, too. But that, and in instances like this, you want to be careful that a hate crime is truly a hate crime and not political correctness gone awry.
Well, I'd just like to finish the point about, because I think Joe made a good point. We don't want to underestimate the power that hate groups can have in this country. We have to pay attention to it. But my point is this, that you do not have, these groups do not enjoy the widespread support of Americans.
These
are fringe groups.
Absolutely.
I mean, the President of the United States does not support this. Nobody in the United States Senate supports this. Now, you do have people, unfortunately, politicians still run on the hate message. There's no question about that. We have that happening here in North Carolina, where we have a politician, I won't even mention his name, who is conflating the role of immigrations and the particular names that people use for illegal immigrants, conflating all that with gay marriage and with a homosexual agenda. You know, the whole, it reminds you of the South during the early 1900s and the last 100 years. So you don't want to dismiss that, but I would just say that our nation is moving to a place where soon we will have, and we already have 42 million Latinos, we're going to be in a period where we will have 100 million Latinos between now and the year 2050. Our country is being transformed. Our notions of race, identity, ethnicity, culture, and fairness or changing, is becoming more mature. We still have people who are afraid. That happens, but we're dealing with it. We're just not the same nation that we were. We're becoming different, and it hurts, and it's painful, and it causes some people who are afraid to, as this in the poverty report, the Poverty Center points out, that we have the rise of hate groups. But they enjoy the support of the United States, the vast majority of Americans.
I just want to move on to another topic. I know that we could go on about this because it is, in some ways, the hottest issue of the day. But also, when you look at how the president is positioning himself on immigration, it reflects the fact that he's in a somewhat vulnerable position. His poll ratings, approval ratings are not very high. And the strategist Karl Rove says Iraq is the leading issue for most Americans. Now, the defense secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, says he isn't sure there will be substantial withdrawals of U.S. troops from Iraq this year as promised by the administration. Tara, is that going to become a big issue? People who were looking for troop reductions now, the secretary of defense saying, nah, not really, nothing we can predict.
Yes. Iraq is the albatross around this administration's neck. And I think what's contributed to the problem here is that the administration hasn't done a very good job of reminding the American people exactly what we're doing over there, why this is relevant to us, why this is a national security issue, why this is in the best interest in the sovereignty of the United States. The American people have forgotten about that. And one of the biggest issues, they need to see something tangible. And when you're bombarded with all of the images of civil unrest in Iraq and soldiers continuing to die, I mean, it's war. And this generation is not used to that. They're used to things being handled quickly and, quick resolution. And in something like this, an undertaking of this magnitude does not happen overnight. I mean, America itself, it took several years before, from the Revolutionary War until we passed the Constitution, it did not happen in 2 years. So there has been a reduction in troop levels from about 160,000 at its peak, about 132,000 now. But they need not to reduce troop levels just to fit political, which way the political winds blow. If that's how the military feels this should be handled, then that's what they should do. But they should only do it with whatever's in the best interest of the boots on the ground in Iraq, and if the Iraqi police forces are trained properly and they begin this transition, that's when the troops should be drawn down and should not be on a political schedule.
It seems like part of the problem is that transition to Iraq is taking full control of their own security is very, very slow, much slower than I think the administration anticipated. And because of that, the administration feels it cannot withdraw its troops. I'm not so sure, though, that the American people have forgotten the mission as defined by George Bush. I think for many Americans, they simply don't buy what he says. I mean, I think that they hear him, they understand him, but many Americans simply don't buy his argument, and I think that's why the poll ratings are so low for him.
Well, I think that's fair. The message has become convoluted, and you are correct with that, and that is the fault of the administration not communicating why we're there more effectively.
I
think they've communicated, but I don't think the message, what has been said, has been accepted by the American people. And I also will say this, that whether the Secretary of Defense will say that the troops are going to be withdrawn, I'm willing to go on record to say before November, there will be some reduction in the troops. And the president is the one who makes that decision, although he'll obviously get some support and input from the Defense Secretary. But there's too much pressure for the administration not to bring some of the troops home before November. This war is very, very, it is unpopular. When you have Karl Rove, who says that the public is sour on the Iraq war, when Karl Rove says that, that's a statement. And he and that statement was made, I think, honestly, and it's a realistic statement, and it also reflects the deep resentment that Americans have for the fact that we've lost 2,400 young people. We have 17,000 people whose lives have been altered immeasurably. And countless thousands of lives have been lost in Iraq. And despite the administration's rhetoric, Americans do not equate what has happened in Iraq directly with the security of this nation. You can stretch it all you want to, but it is not there, and the administration has not made the case and will not make the case.
We have less than 2 minutes left. I just want to throw out something personal, kind of unusual for me, but I have a cousin who's in Iraq right now, and I got an emailed picture of him with the defense secretary, who I guess had gone to visit. But, you know, I know people have died in his battalion, and it's very difficult to get information on what's happening with the troops on the ground. I just want to ask Joe, how much contact are you able to have with the troops that are on the front lines?
Well, you mean in terms of reporters?
In terms of reporting on the troops on the front lines, is it difficult to get that kind of information for the Washington Post?
Well, I think it's clearly difficult because it's a war situation, and it's difficult because of the not only is it just a war as in any war, but this is a situation where the war is with insurgents, and so reporters have a much more difficult time in simply traveling throughout the city of Baghdad or other parts of the country, and that's one reason you'll find some troops. Some reporters are with the troops, are embedded with the troops to get you know, kind of that first person view of what's going on with the particular group of troops they're with. That of course presents just a one sided picture. If you're just with one group of soldiers, you aren't getting the full story. But in answer to your question, yes, it's very difficult. In some ways, perhaps more difficult than in other situations because of the kind of war this is.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but certainly I hope that we get more firsthand information, and we're going to keep an eye on the immigration debate. In Washington, D.C., we were just talking to Joe Davidson, an editor at The Washington Post, also Tara Settmeyer, a Republican strategist, and in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University. We'd like to hear your comments on the topics you've heard on the roundtable. You can call us at 202-408-3330. That's 202-408-3330. Or you can send an email by logging on to npr.org. Please be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.